welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. You know, I like to think of Garden Talk as your weekly resource for all things gardening. What about that? We've got plenty to talk about today on the show. For example, Bruce Bagenberg is back with us. He's the statewide horticulture outreach specialist, resides in the horticulture program of UW-Madison's Division of Extension. He also writes a weekly gardening column. It's called Wisconsin Yard and Garden, and I look through it all the time, and it's a good column to read every week. We'll talk to him about how to get the most out of your gardening catalogs. We'll take your other gardening questions as well, and I hope you'll join in. Maybe you got a question about catalogs, or maybe just something happening in your own garden or landscape. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Bruce Bagenberg, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Morning, Larry. Yeah, great to be back.
Many of us are getting gardening catalogs in the mail about now. Have you gotten any?
No.
You know, I was thinking about this morning. I can think back, 20 years. Holy cow. My mailbox would be...
Yeah, I think more has come and gone to the online format now. Yeah, you're right. It used to be right after the first of the year. Yeah, the mailbox was full.
Yeah, it's changed a bit. Do you have some favorites? Of course, you can view them online, but...
I stick a lot of to the traditional ones, especially with vegetables. I like to look at, different varieties with, what's coming up. But a lot of times you look at the new ones, but you end up with the old standbys anyways. But it's always nice to look.
Yeah, it's always fun to look. I like the Baker Creek catalog, the big one. They have two. One's free. It's about 150 pages or so. And their whole seed catalog, that's always around 500 pages. And I think that sells for $15.
Yeah, I mean, some of those get to be like reference books, as you look at them.
Well, they're a lot of fun. Should we be ordering now?
Yeah, I mean, you can order, especially seeds. Certainly you can. Obviously, it's a little too early to be starting them indoors, even in the southern part of the state, but it's never too early to think about it. But that's one of the points I made when I did that column is, you've got some time in it's always great to look at what's available and look at new things and that, but do your homework. You got plenty of time and then place the order rather than, feel rushed and place the order and then find out, I really don't need this or I need some different stuff or, whatever it might be. Think it over. We're only in the first part here, January.
Yeah. Scientific names, what's a good reference? I mean, they come up a lot and people never want, well, most people, I should say, don't want to use those names.
Correct. I think,
myself
again,
included.
Yeah. The challenge not only to pronounce them, but to spell them. Spell check doesn't like them on your computer either. It's kind of, if you look at where its highest priority would be with woody ornamentals and herbaceous plants, because there's a lot of confusion. When you're dealing with fruit crops and vegetables, you really don't need it. I mean, you're looking at tomato, watermelon, whatever it is. But cultivars become more important, when you're looking at vegetable crops. But a really good example I always use when dealing with Latin names or scientific names, botanical names, it all refers to the same thing. When I used to teach the tree and shrub class, we'd always look at the example of maple. Acer is the genus of maple. And the common example, there's so much misidentification, is with the Crimson King Norway maples, which have the maroon, reddish, purplish maroon. There's some other ones. There's Crimson Queen. There's some other ones there. But on the, typically if someone sees that tree, they see the maroon foliage during the summer and they call it a red maple. A Norway maple and red maple are entirely, two entirely different species that are much different. Red maple is a native tree that's somewhat finicky and where you put it, likes acidic soil. Norway maple is not native. It's kind of become naturalized in areas, but it's much more durable and adaptable. But they're two entirely different trees. So if you went to the nursery thinking, I want a red maple because I saw one down the street, they're going to put you on an entirely different tree than you were thinking. But if you went with the botanical name, you know, Acer rubrum is red maple. Acer platinodes is Norway maple. Then you get into the nomenclature. And the key part with that Norway maple is the cultivar, Crimson King, is that maroon one that you're looking at. The species Norway maple is just a green tree. There's nothing special about it.
Yeah. You mentioned cultivars a couple of times. I got into a discussion with a friend about varieties and cultivars because he was calling a variety or a cultivar a variety. And I've actually, it's interesting. Talk about that, the difference between a cultivar and a variety.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I mean, in reality, you know, when you're dealing with catalogs, it's not that big of a deal. But technically, they are different. A variety is a natural variation of a species. So essentially, it'd be a plant that was discovered. And you see a lot of that with ornamental plants. Cultivar is essentially man-made through crop breeding. So think of cultivar as cultivated. Think of variety as a variant. You're talking about the same thing. You're talking about something that's different within a species. It's not enough difference to make it a new species, but it can be very significant. You know, we deal with landscape plants. It could be the size of the plant, the color of the flower. With vegetables, it can be one of the big things that I always stress is disease resistance. It could also be the flavor. It could be the size. You know, tomatoes are a good example. You have, you know, the big tomatoes. You have the small patio tomatoes. Those are all different cultivars in most cases. So, yeah. But yeah, technically they're different, but in reality, people interchange them, you know, and a lot of times variety kind of overrules cultivar when in discussion. Technically they're different.
Yeah. Well, that conversation got me going down the rabbit hole a little bit. And we'd been talking about apple trees. Mm-hmm. And Macintosh apples came up in the discussion. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to look up Macintosh apples history. And a guy by the name of John Macintosh, Canadian guy, you probably know this already, discovered this tree. And he really liked the apples that it produced. And so, of course, it's John Macintosh, so he named it the Macintosh. Mm-hmm. And he and his wife started grafting back around 1820 or so, and grafting the tree and selling it. And if you think about it, if you have a Macintosh tree or any other cultivar, you have... Well, with a Macintosh case, you have basically John Macintosh's tree. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a one of the readings I saw. It's like a living museum that you have in your property, be it a Macintosh or any other kind of tree, or even and of course vegetables, same kind of the same way.
Yeah, and that's, you know, gets into the genetics. But yeah, when you deal with grafting or cuttings that are taken with trees, including fruit trees and ornamental plants, trees and shrubs, you're right. Essentially, you have clones that continually go along and there's no genetic change at all. So in theory, you're looking at a plant that, you know, 100, 200 years ago, somebody might have had, and you have it in your backyard. It's technically the same genetics that you had. Yeah, and then you get into the other thing, and we used to always do this in some of our classes too, where you talk about, now what happens if I take the seed off of that tree, out of that apple? Now what happened? Well, now you got a whole different ballgame because something else came in and pollinated it, and you have no idea what you might get. If you did take that seed and then grew it out as a tree, then you create something new. But
yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah,
it is. It is. And there again, with varieties, a lot of times you assume, well, if it's Macintosh, you're assuming that that person, you know, made some kind of a cross way back when, but in reality, they may have discovered that plant and then they just continually vegetative propagation. You continue to keep those genetics and now you give it a different name. And a lot of times it is the name of the person that discovered it.
And you wind up with, in other cases, you wind up with somebody that's crossing trees or plants for, you know, various characteristics.
Yeah, and that's in particular with vegetable crops, both for home gardens and commercially. I mean, now you're looking at certain characteristics, and this brings up debates when you get into heirloom vegetables. People say, well, you know, why I don't want to change the genetics of this tomato that we've grown for generations, but from a commercial standpoint, it may have really good flavor, but it's also extremely susceptible to disease. So now you make a cross with something else to bring in the disease resistance. And then the argument is, have you lost the flavor? You know, whatever that trait might have been. So one of the ways around that, you can actually graft tomato plants. You can keep the old heirloom variety, the fruit that you like, but it's really disease susceptible, graft it onto a disease-resistant rootstock. Because technically, when you graft a plant, you've not changed its identity. You've got technically two plants, the rootstock and the scion. It's a little more involved with tomatoes. It's pretty tedious, but it can be done. And it brings, you know, a lot of discussion. And you can, like I say, you can go back and forth and talk about different things with people and test their knowledge botanically, what's going on. But, you know, a lot of things are, you know, really interesting if you really follow what's going on. But technically, when you graft a plant, you technically have two different plants as one. So
yeah, you do indeed. And when you get this, I'm thinking of seeds now, like from a seed catalog. A lot of times you'll see something like VF on the packet itself, and that means that it's resistant to, I think, Butycerium and Verticillium and Fusarium. Mm-hmm. So that's
correct.
The VF.
Yeah, and that's another thing that I know I stressed in that column, and I've done this for years when I talked about, you know, disease control. One of your best tools, especially for vegetable crops, and when you have certain diseases like Verticillium you mentioned, Fusarium you mentioned, those are both fungi that are in the soil. There's not much you can do with those. You know, there aren't sprays or anything like that. But if you have a plant that has genetic resistance, it's not immune to the disease, but it can still produce a crop if that disease is present. And that's always the best example is tomatoes. You know, when you're looking at disease resistance, look for VF, which stands for Verticillium Fusarium. You may also see N, which stands for root.nematode, which is another problem in the soil that's very difficult to control, but if you have a resistant plant. So ideally with a tomato, you pick out a VFN, you've got resistance to three major problems that are in the soil. You haven't even planted it yet, but you've taken steps to prevent the problem from occurring.
Yeah. Bruce Bangenberg, our guest today, statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the Hort program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Questions for him? We went down the rabbit hole a little bit on a couple of things relating to catalogs and cultivars versus varieties. And I always find that interesting. You may have something of a more practical nature relating to your own garden, and aside from it, whether it's a variety or a cultivar, and you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Coming up at noon today, DNR Forest Health Specialist Paul Segan is back with us to talk about protecting your trees from winter weather. So that's coming up in our second segment of the show today. Right now, we're visiting with Bruce Spangenberg, statewide horticulture outreach specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Extension. And we're talking about garden catalogs, protecting your plants. We're talking about any question you may have actually relating to the garden. And again, join in. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. We are, it's got a call coming up from Minocqua. We'll get to that in just a minute here. How can you make sure a plant will do well in your landscape?
Start out with, you know, what the fundamentals, sun versus shade. You know, if you're looking at shrubs, herbaceous plants, ground covers, start with that. Look at specific soil needs. You know, certain plants may have a wide range of soil, so tolerates. Others might be really finicky where they need an acidic soil, for example, which is fairly common up here in the northern part of the state, but it's not very common in the southern part. And then look at, after that, does it fit in your scheme? You know, if you have a landscape plan, you know, will it fit with what already exists, or do you have a certain theme you want to put in if you're dealing with a herbaceous perennial border, whatever it might be? Look at maintenance needs. Look at how pest prone it is, if it is pest prone or disease susceptible. Does it need a lot of pruning? Does it need a lot of irrigation, fertilization, that kind of thing? So basically, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, do your homework. You know, when you're looking at plants, you know, if you see a plant in a catalog, it's always good to check another resource other than that catalog, because obviously, I mean, there's good information, like we talked about. There's some catalogs that are like almost like a manual you may have to purchase. But keep in mind that that particular nursery or that company is selling a product. So make sure, kind of go to a neutral site if you can, like Extension, for example. We have a lot of things on websites here on our site, and other states have similar, where you can look up a particular plant and maybe get an idea. Is it really a low maintenance plant, or is it really a good choice? Does it have any drawbacks? And that, again, make sure you have the identity of the plant. That's why I mentioned that, especially with herbaceous plants and trees and shrubs. So there's a lot of things that go there, but start with the fundamentals, you know, sun versus shade. What are you looking for? Do you want a big plant, a small plant, something to create a hedge or a privacy screen, something to fit in with already some plants that already exist there, all those kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Roger in Minocqua, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling, Roger. What's on your mind?
I have two questions. Thanks for taking my call. The first one is, do you know of any particular seed catalogs that grow or are specialized in vegetables and trees specific for our northern climate?
Okay, and you had another one too?
The other question is, I read the plant vegetables say summer for a fall harvest. Well, our season is short. Should the summer be more is planted in spring so that I can get, say, a watermelon or a cantaloupe before the first frost?
Okay. So how early is planting season in the Minocqua area is basically, I think, what Roger's, that second question was about. And the first was, are there seed catalogs that specialize in seeds for northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, excellent questions. Actually, I'm right down the road from Minocqua. a couple things. What you look for, with the answer is yes. Most seed catalogs actually do cater to the, you know, the north, to the Midwest. And what you can specifically look for, like you mentioned, something like a watermelon or a pumpkin or a squash. A lot of times you have cultivars or varieties that will say they're ideal for northern gardens because they have a shorter time from planting to harvest. You know, that's always a drawback for us in the entire state of Wisconsin, but especially in the northern part of the state. You know, we have to wait till the threat of frost is over in, you know, late May, early June to plant. And then we, on the other end, we've got early frost coming in sometimes in September, which really shortens our growing season. So a couple steps to help with that. Look for varieties with intended for northern gardens, or a lot of times they'll give you that time interval from planting to harvest. So one variety might say 60 days, another one might say 80 days, one might say 100 days. You know, think about our growing season. You definitely want something that's under 100 days to make sure that you can get it in and get it harvested before the cold weather in the fall. And the other way around that to help is also with crops like watermelons, squash, plant them ahead of time, you know, start them as seeds and then put them in the garden as a transplant rather than direct seeding in the garden. That will help. The other thing that helps a lot when the time comes in planting, you can do some things to help kind of increase the heat around those plants with mulching, with row covers, that kind of thing to get a jump on the season. Not just here in northern Wisconsin, that's done statewide. That's been, you know, when I was in northern Illinois, that was a thing that a lot of commercial growers did with crops like tomatoes and cantaloupe to get a jump on the season. They put out row covers in the field, and that would get your harvest, you know, 10, 14 days earlier than if you didn't do that. So those kind of things. And then with herbaceous plants and woody plants, if you look in that direction, again, a lot of nurseries cater to the north. It's always good if you can to select plants that are locally grown or grown in a Midwest nursery rather than one down in Georgia or in the Carolinas or something, and make sure it's hardy. You know, we've got the hardiness zone map that's been updated recently.
What's Minocqua, 4A, 4B?
Yeah, most of 3 has disappeared. Oh, yeah. And, you know, again, the updated USDA hardiness zone map was done in 2023. They're looking at 30 years worth of climate data. So zone 4 for us, zone 5 for most of the southern part of the state. You got some zone 6 right along Lake Michigan. But look for hardiness with perennial plants. That's really not a concern with vegetable crops. But vegetable crops, you're more looking at how long does it take from planting to harvest.
Yeah. Well, Roger was asking about melons. What, are there good melons for the Minocqua area or that area, those zone 4 areas?
Sure. Yeah, again, get a jump on the season. I'd put them out as transplants rather than direct seed. Especially in a smaller home garden, it's very easy to put row covers out. You can buy them commercially. You can make them yourself. You can use the floating row covers that are kind of a fabric, or what actually works better are the clear plastic row covers where you put like some metal. You make like a hoop, mini hoop house essentially over your plants. And that'll, like I said, that'll give you a good 2-week head start on the season.
Yeah. What about if you're planting, let's say, the watermelon, use that as an example, when would you start that seed indoors?
You probably want to work backwards, you know, roughly a month or 6 weeks. So there again, for us, really most of the state, crops like watermelon, you know, the warm-loving crops, watermelon, cantaloupe, eggplant, you're not going to want to put those in until the very end of May or even the first week of June. So if you work backwards, sometimes the seed packet will help you with that, but you're probably looking at late April, sometime in April to start them indoors. You don't want to start them too early because then you got plants that are getting, you know, way too big and it's hard to transplant them and that kind of thing, but kind of work backwards. But generally you're looking.
Oop. We lost Bruce there for a second. Bruce Spangenberg, our guest today, we're talking with him about, well, we've been dealing a lot with seeds and catalogs, but you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. I think we might have Bruce back. Bruce, you're there?
Yeah, I saw something and it said I'd lost low or unstable internet or something. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, fine.
Okay.
So you were talking about working backwards.
Yeah. So if you're looking at, you know, realistically, you're going to put those plants out the last week of May. You're probably going to start them in your house mid to late April. You know, kind of resist the temptation to plant them too early because then they get too big inside and they're more difficult to transplant. You know, sometimes you see people with tomatoes that already are flowering and they're still in the pot in the house or in the flat in the house, or you know, they got put in a little too early, or you had to wait too long because the weather just wouldn't cooperate.
Well, and then there's the other part, which is the first time I did transplants, I grew some tomato plants. And then I took them right straight out from inside to outside. And the next morning, they were all flat, lacking chlorophyll of any kind, and laying on the ground. Oh, man, I was so mad at myself. Oh, you need to kind of get them ready for that.
Yeah, right. You need to acclimate them or harden them off, because that's an excellent point, and that holds true with plants grown in a greenhouse as well. Indoors are in that perfect environment. They've got light, they've got humidity, and then you put them outside, it's drier, it's windy, and it's just a very harsh change. So you want to kind of gradually, you know, put them out for a couple hours, put them back in, do that for a few days so that they get hardened off so that you don't see that. Or if you can protect them, you know, put them in the ground and then put something over them to keep them out of the wind for and out of the sun for a couple of days, that can help.
Yeah. Heather in Prentice has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Heather.
Hi, I have a question. I have an apple tree that was planted on our property when we moved in, and I'm not sure what it is. I have asked a fellow at an orchard to try to identify it. He thought it was a red Cortland, but I have never eaten such a delicious apple. It's sweet, and it's like candy. My grandkids think it's just delicious. So I would really like to graft some of it, because the tree is kind of old, and I want to, you know, see if I can't keep it going. When is the right time to graft, to like take a cutting from that tree that and to actually attempt grafting? And what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's best to graft when they're dormant. So time-wise, you're at a good time. And generally what's done is people will take cuttings of the variety you want, like this tree. So you're going to take twig cuttings or, you know, branch cuttings, small twigs, try to get the newer growth on it. And then you need a rootstock. Now most apple rootstock, very commonly, they're actually crab apples that are, because they're hardy and they can also control the size of the plant that you grafted onto it. So what you might want to do is contact a orchard supply nursery. You may or probably won't find anything locally, but you know, Hilltop is one of them. And they may sell you a rootstock. They could make a suggestion, and then it's kind of hit or miss. You know, grafting is an art. Obviously, you want the scion or the apple that you like. It has to be compatible with the rootstock, and the orchard supply can help you with that. But essentially, you're going to graft them on, and then you can do that indoors, like in a greenhouse or in an unheated building. And then you need a little bit of time for that graft union to bind together. You have to get what's called callus tissue to grow to kind of seal it. And then you like to do all this before the growing season, and then put it outside and give it the opportunity to grow. So what I encourage you to do is check with some of the, you know, go online, get some of the orchard nursery supply type organization or outfits, nurseries, and then see if they can help you with some ideas on a good compatible rootstock, and you could order it from them. And then they may have some guidelines. You can go online and see. I'm sure there's things on YouTube on how to graft and that kind of thing. A lot of it's trial and error, but if you have a tree like that, you know, you can experiment with it. If you get a good hardy rootstock, your chances of success are pretty good.
Yeah, they are. I was trying to remember, there's a famous book about grafting, and I can't recall the author's name, but that's a ways back. But you're right. You can go online nowadays and probably find a pretty good video of doing it.
Yeah, and in fact, I think there's even some, I want to say it was either Penn State or Cornell. I just saw something the other day. I was just going through stuff online. They had a free online course on grafting and taking cuttings and that kind of thing. So you can look for that too, give you some ideas, and I'm sure there's videos as well, even if it's not a live course. But it's something to experiment with, and it's fun. You know, really the key thing with grafting is just whatever you decide to graft onto needs to be compatible. So like I said, if you're dealing with an apple, either another apple or a crab apple, and more commonly it's going to be a crab apple for the rootstock, and then you're matching, they'll show you what's called the cambium, which is the growth right under the bark. You have to match the cambium layer of the cutting part, which is the scion, to the rootstock and get that to bind together. And once you do, you've got you know, a successful graft. There are limitations because we used to talk about grafting when I, you know, in some of our courses, and people say, well, can I take a oak and graft it onto a birch? No, you can't. They're not, you know, they're way different as far as being related, but apples and crab apples, very compatible. You can graft those two together.
Brett in Southern Dane County, your turn now. Hi, Brett.
Great show, Larry. Happy New Year. We're going to miss you, man. We love you.
Thank you.
Yeah, down at the Capitol, they have a lot of graft and corruption, but I think that's different. So this is more of a macro question. I worked to help build a house out near Aspen, Colorado, that had a 900-square-foot greenhouse attached to it. They got heat from that, and they were able to raise bananas and a lot of their own food in that. Has anybody done a study on how much of our own food, and including fruits and vegetables, we could grow over the winter in Wisconsin, which is similar to Colorado, and cut our food imports from foreign countries that way? So,
yeah. Okay.
I think I'm sure there's information out there, but the biggest challenge with that is cost. You know, you could, in theory, make a greenhouse or construct a greenhouse facility and grow fruit crops, for example. But you have to look at how much is it going to cost to heat that. You know, that's always a stumbling block for the North. As a hobby, yeah, but if it's going to be a commercial venture that's going to sell that crop, the cost of that crop may be so high that it's just not realistic. So, plus, that was nothing here. But it's a great idea, and I'm certainly... There's a lot going on with, you know, things like hydroponics indoors, which you can do in the North. And you can, if you can figure out the economics of it, there's a lot of things, not necessarily bananas, but you can do things like, you know, a lot of vegetable crops, lettuce, you can grow strawberries. You can do a lot of things hydroponically in relatively condensed space where you can save on the cost, and it can be an economic venture. You know, there's some of that going on. So,
well, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of possibilities. It always comes down to, you know, what's the bottom line? Can we make it work to run a company, you know, and exist financially?
Well, once in a while on the show, I've had some, couple of guys from, or a guy from McFarland area, southern Wisconsin. They have a greenhouse and they sell. And they raise the crops in the wintertime. Well, they figured out a way to do it to make, you know, come out. And it's certainly being done right here in Wisconsin in some fashion, at least on the commercial scale.
It is. And the other thing that's happening is extending the season.
Yeah.
You know, by putting out you know, like hoop houses and doing things, row tunnels, that kind of thing, where you have almost like a mini greenhouse put out in the field. It's not necessarily heated, but you can extend the season. And some of those long crops, you have more time for harvest, or maybe you can get a double crop in, extend your season, and then have fresh produce available for a longer period of time than the traditional field way of growing it.
Brett, thanks again for calling. Good questions there. Nancy in Ridgeland, we'll go to you. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
Say, you were talking about the grafting of the apple branches with that sweet apple tree, and it reminded me of what a friend of mine did many years ago in Orchard Ridge, right in Madison there, and they had, I don't know if it was originally a crab apple tree or an apple tree or just what it was, but they grafted branches of, I think, two or maybe three different kinds of apples on the same tree, and they also had pears on the same tree. And I thought that was pretty interesting that they could graft them in and have all these different kind of fruits, and they already had a solid rootstock in the ground. They didn't have to start from scratch.
Nancy, thank you very much for calling. Bruce, that sure can be done.
Yep, and again, you just follow the basic rule of if they're compatible, you can do it. And you can buy those. You'll see those in some of the catalogs where they'll have the 3-in-1, not just with apples. They'll do that with the crab apple where you can have white, pink, and red flowers on the same tree. You can do that with hibiscus. You can have multiple colors on the same plant. It's just following the same fundamentals. The only challenge, in addition to making sure they're compatible, every time you make a graft, that is a weaker structural part of the plant. So if you have, for example, an apple you've got a good rootstock and you have three different varieties or cultivars grafted onto that, there's three potential places where it could fail in an ice storm and wind and that kind of thing. So just a heads up on that. But yeah, you can be creative. You can do a lot of things.
Nancy, thank you. Yeah, appreciate the call. Ron in Manitowoc County, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ron.
Thanks, Larry. Your book on grafting that you were looking for the author may be a deer, Mr. Deer. Two questions. The first, for Bruce, is there any native shrub or tree in Wisconsin that could be used as rootstock for apple scions that would display a dwarfing ability? And the second question is, beech trees send up root sprouts from the roots that the root itself is around 1 inch in diameter or more, and there are no root hairs nearby. Is it possible to produce a tree from some of these sprouts, and how would you do it? Thank you.
Yeah. Couple of things there. We got.
Yeah, I think the first one there, looking for a native tree or shrub to graft on if you're dealing with apples, would be a native crab apple. Which would control the size and would be hardy and that type of thing. Like I said, a lot of apples already are grafted onto crab apple of some type. There again, it's going to be trial and error, but I don't, and maybe there's somebody doing it. I don't know anybody personally, but there could be that someone's already doing that. The other thing, the shoots coming out of the ground kind of thing, you want to be careful. And that, it brings up another excellent point. Remember, you're dealing with a scion, which is one variety or cultivar, the rootstock is another. So for example, if I graft an apple onto a crab apple and I've got this tree and I'm harvesting the fruit off the scion, which is the apple part that I grafted on, if I get a sucker coming out of the base and I let it develop, or sometimes if I lose the scion and I leave the root in the ground and I get new growth, I think it looks great. What happens when it finally flowers is I have a crab apple because that's the original rootstock. So if you're going to use vegetative material to graft, you want to be certain of its identity. And anything coming out of the ground, the risk is it's the rootstock, which is not, it's got the features of hardiness you want, maybe controlling the size of the plant you want, but it's not the fruit that you want.
Yeah.
And you may not realize that until 4 or 5 years later when it finally does flower and fruit. Then you realize, why aren't these apples getting any bigger than golf ball size? Well, it's because it was a crab apple. Yeah.
Okay. Ron, thanks again. Joni in Arena, your turn. Hi, Joni.
Yeah, good morning, Larry. I have a question about black knot. Every apple tree I have ever grown will develop black knot at one time or the other. How do I control it?
Black knot, yeah.
Yeah, black knot's a fungus. You get like the black, like corky growth on it. It's a genetic thing, and it goes back to resistance versus susceptibility. So, you know, all you can really do when you see it and is prune it out, and doing it in the dormant season is ideal to help prevent it spreading further. Sterilize your pruners, cut it out below, you know, go some inches below where you see that black corky growth into healthy tissue and cut that twig off and get rid of it. But some are more susceptible than others. So if you have it, and you take cuttings to graft off of that tree, you're going to keep that susceptibility, unfortunately. So look for black knot resistance. It's much more prevalent in plums. But yeah, it is a concern. You see it in the wild cherries, wild plums. But you'll see it now this time of year on the dormant plants. You can see that black corky kind of growth. It's tough to deal with. If a plant's really heavily infested, not much you can do. It may not totally kill it, but it's certainly going to disfigure it, and it's not, you just can't get rid of it.
There you go, Joni. Thank you so much for calling. Bruce Spangenberg, our guest today, statewide horticulture outreach specialist in the Hort program at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Monday at this time, Jesse LeGrue is going to be taking your tech questions. Then we'll talk about winter fire safety and finally take a look at the history of the mafia in Milwaukee. Looking forward to all of those. Right now, though, we're talking gardening with Bruce Bangenberg, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. Jason in Greenbush, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I appreciate having me on, and I appreciate you and your years of service. Thank you for all that.
Thank you.
I wanted to share, got a little itch back in 2021 when it was COVID era, and wanted to continue my growing season throughout winter. So I needed to take down an old fence around the garden and shopped around for some free windows on Facebook and dug myself what's called a Wally Panini or in-ground greenhouse. And so dug it down about 8 feet or so and 6 feet wide, 20 feet long, and put it on a slightly north-facing hill, which wasn't the best, but it surprisingly worked. I was able to grow vegetables such as lettuce, spinach, and even a lemon tree I was able to grow in there and continue to grow.
Oh, very, very cool. And I was thinking about a friend of mine, Jason, Chuck Johnson. Charlie had gotten an old used boat hoist. And he, you know, the metal frame, it's a kind of an oval frame, and he put some visqueen or, you know, some sort of material over it and made his own greenhouse with that. And that extent, what that did was let him get started much earlier in the season and then extended it out on the other end. And, he had pretty darn good luck with it.
Yeah, that's a lot of things. Like I said, there's a lot of that being done now with even commercial vegetable growers that are, you know, experimenting with row tunnels out in the field. For that reason, you can start earlier, but especially extend the season in the fall.
Yeah. Jason,
I was going to say the key thing there, a lot of, you know, like you said, a lot of different things you can do with material that you might have available. You know, your basics are make sure you get enough light in there. And then the other issue you always run into is ventilation. You know, make sure you got a way to ventilate, because sometimes you don't think of it in Wisconsin, but it can get way too hot in those greenhouses that you make in addition to being too cold.
Good point. Jason, thanks again. Appreciate it. Crystal in Rhinelander, what's on your mind?
I am wondering what is happening to the lilacs in the area. In the summer, the leaves turn black and drop off. Is it a virus? Is it a fungus? And what can we do about it? Yeah. These are mainly the old-fashioned lilacs.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that most likely is Septoria, leaf spot or leaf blight, which is a fungus. And it's not a new disease, but it's relatively new as far as being a big problem. And it occurred two seasons ago. Kind of, you know, a lot of people kind of caught off guard because they hadn't seen it much, because we had just the right conditions and a lot of rainfall early in the year and the leaves get infected. So it is difficult to deal with. I believe you could use fungicides. They'd have to be put onto the plant as the leaves develop to try to help protect them. Try to increase air circulation if you can by pruning. Light penetration air circulation will help a little bit so the foliage dries out faster. But it's hard to say, you know, how that's going to, you know, long term, is that going to be a problem every year, or is that something that kind of sprung up and now maybe it'll fade away? Sometimes that happens. But that is a fungus problem.
Crystal, thank you very much. We had an email from Heidi in Poplar, asking if I will be making an appearance at the Garden Expo in a seminar or demo. She didn't see my name on the schedule. And I can say that I will indeed be at I always call it the Garden Expo, but it's really the official name is the Garden and Green Living Expo. Mm-hmm. And I will be hosting the Garden Talk radio show from there. And we're making a kind of a big deal out of it because it's my last time, you know, before I retire. And so I think they've even added some space. So that Friday of the Garden Expo, I will be broadcasting from 11 to 1. And I hope to have a little time afterwards. They've expanded the number of seating and all that, and hoping that a lot of folks will show up. And perhaps I'll have some time. Well, I'll take the time to talk to folks after the show's over and answer questions and that sort of thing. And we'll have a whole lot more about that as we get closer. When, I'm trying to remember the dates for it.
It's Valentine's weekend. 13,
yeah, it's always kind of Valentine's weekend. And actually, I think it officially opens at noon on Friday, but
yeah, Friday the 13th.
Yeah, except we get in early, so if you're going to the show, you'll be able to get in early to see the show in action. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing this for years with Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson, so we can cover a pretty broad range of topics when we get together, and of course answer people's questions who call in or email or those in the studio. So Heidi, I will indeed be there, and it'll be Friday of the Garden Expo, and we'll be broadcasting starting at 11. I'm sure you'll be able to get in early. We'll have the specifics on that coming up pretty quickly, if I'm not mistaken. I just did a little feature to promote the Garden and Green Living Expo about an hour ago, as a matter of fact. So you'll be hearing that. That was more general. The more specifics about my own presentation or appearance, we'll have that later on. What were the most questions? You know, we're kind of looking back here. What were the most questions you got? What were the topics that most often came up for you, Bruce?
For this past year?
Yeah.
The way we're kind of set up right now, most of the lawn questions come to me in our statewide network. So certainly crabgrass was the number one lawn question or problem of the 2025 season. Beyond that, you know, just a lot of, probably trees would be next, you know, tree problems in general, whether it be a fungal disease like apple scab, or if it's a cultural thing, you know, where a tree is too close to a building or it had construction damage, that kind of thing, or just odd weather kind of things that are coming up. But certainly in turfgrass, the number one thing this year was crabgrass.
Yeah. What are you looking forward to in this year? What do you think's gonna be the issue this year?
Who knows? It'll be. I mean, it's just. That's an excellent question, though, because you really can't predict that far ahead. You know, obviously, the two big things as the season unfolds is temperature and moisture. You know, what happens? So, do we get a cold, wet spring? Do we get a hot, dry spring? Do we get a really wet early summer? You know, that's going to have a huge influence on fungal diseases. And, you know, crabgrass, like I mentioned last year, what happened is, especially in the southern half of the state, we actually saw a lot of turf damage because we had no snow cover in the southern part of the state, and we had some pretty cold weather. So lawns are, you know, kind of damaged. They were slow coming out of the spring, and then we got warm weather and we got rain, and it was perfect. Crabgrass literally, you know, just almost overnight took over. So, you know, so what'll happen this year? It's hard to say. You know, we've got plenty of snow in the northern part of the state.
We got none here.
Yeah, years are gone. So will it set up again? You really don't know. But that's always tough. Makes it a challenge.
Bruce, it's always fun to have you with us. Thanks so much. We'll look forward to another visit. Thank you, Bruce.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Bruce Mangenberg, statewide horticulture outreach specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Great to have him with us. We're going to continue with a look at our trees and shrubs here in the state and what we can do to help them through the winter. And, of course, take your questions. That's coming up. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here. Thanks for joining us today, talking about trees now with Paul Segan. He's the DNR Forest Health Specialist in Northwest Wisconsin, but I believe he can answer questions about trees in any part of the state. I'm pretty sure of that. Well, we're going to start out by talking about the effect of weather fluctuations on trees, and then we'll go back to look at pruning, and Paul will have some advice to share on planting trees in the spring. And already have a question up, and you may have one too. If you have a question about your trees, maybe about pruning, give us a call. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Paul Segan, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be back with you.
You know what? We got Dave Inacio on's got a question that relates, and we'll just go right there. Dave, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. My question is about oak wilt.
Okay.
We've been having some trees harvested, and we've had quite a bit of it. And I was wondering how long it period of time should elapse after you harvested before the threat of it is, well, more or less gone.
Yeah, and it, in other words, before you might want to plant another oak tree in the same place, maybe, Dave?
Exactly. And also a follow-up, maybe, is there a big difference in susceptibility between red oak and white oak and maybe other varieties too?
Yeah,
that's a good question, Dave. You know, the first thing I think about with oak wilt is making sure you get a proper diagnosis. And oftentimes that is coming from a lab-based result. So at the DNR, we have forest health specialists who can come out and schedule a site visit of your property and collect wood samples or branch samples and have them tested at our lab to determine if oak wilt is the cause of the mortality. Because there's some other things that can look like oak wilt, we want to make sure it really is truly oak wilt. The other thing that folks who own yard trees can do is they can collect samples on their own and send them to the plant disease diagnostic clinic. And that includes oak wilt and a whole host of other pathogens that can be tested. Now, once you've confirmed oak wilt, the question is, will you manage or will you let it go? Some cases, it may make sense to let it go if it's going to have a relatively low impact on the forest, because there might be many other species there besides oak, and the loss of oak might be minimal. But in the case where you do want to control it, there's a few different control measures that we've outlined very well on some of the documents on our website. We have an oak wilt management fact sheet that talks all about the different control measures for oak wilt that involve using both insect pesticides like herbicides, as well as trenching that uses mechanical means to do so. With regard to your question specifically in planting, you know, seedlings into an area that's been affected by oak wilt, if you're planting red oak or white oak seedlings, it's generally not an issue. And the reason is by the time those seedlings establish a large enough root system, it's very unlikely that the oak wilt that's in the established older root systems of the mature trees will graft onto the young trees. And so the threat would probably be nil to none. So I really wouldn't worry about that once you've, you know, implemented a control in that site. With regard to whether or not white oaks or red oaks are more or less susceptible, it's a great question. We do see that there's a spectrum of susceptibility whereby red oaks are highly susceptible to oak wilt if they're injured during that period of April through July. They tend to get infected pretty quickly if there's oak wilt in the area, if there's infected wood in the area, or if there's other oak wilt trees that are left standing and dead. White oaks tend to be more resistant to oak wilt. They can get oak wilt. They can even be killed by oak wilt. But oftentimes what we see is they are able to use some of their natural wood anatomy and some of the structures in that wood to stop oak wilt from spreading through them. So white oaks, if we do have oak wilt in the area, are probably the species we would want to hope for, because they're less likely to get it and more likely to survive. Those are great questions, though, Dave.
Yeah, great question to start out. And bur oaks are another that are sort of similar to white oak in that they don't look the same, but they certainly have some resistance to oak wilt, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's true. You know, if I think on a spectrum, I'd say red is on the far end of highly susceptible. Burr is probably intermediate, and then white is more resistant. So burr probably falls somewhere in the middle. And so the good news, though, is that we don't tend to see grafting or this below ground transmission of oak wilt between, say, a red and a white oak or a burr oak and white oak as often, because the species don't tend to graft between each other with their roots as often. So if you see a mix of oak that in a stand, that's really a good situation from a standpoint of being resistant and resilient to oak wilt.
Yeah. Dave, thank you very much. Good question. Appreciate it. And here we are on to John in Port Wing with, you mentioned white oak, and I think John has a question about white oak. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Yes. Thanks for taking me on. It's real timely. Up here in northwest Wisconsin, where I am, we had some real nasty weather, and I've got a young white oak I planted about 20 years ago, and it's been stretching its legs real well. It loaded up with slush and stuff in the top and busted off. Took about top 15 feet and broke it off.
Oh.
And I'm wondering, can I get up in there and cut that out? It's still hanging in there, and cut that out, get below the shattered part, and will that form a new leader? Have I got any hope for that tree?
Yeah, that's a great question, John. We did see the Thanksgiving blizzard this year, if you want to call it that. And then, of course, we remember the 2022 blue blizzard. And these rain events that are followed by snow are pretty dramatic in terms of loading up these trees with a lot of heavy ice and snow and leading to bending them over and sometimes breaking these branches and leaders like you're seeing. And I had some of the same occur in my yard, and all throughout my zone, I was seeing a lot of birch leaned over and a lot of aspen. I would recommend in your case that in any tree really that's heavily loaded with snow, if we do get a warm up that happens, temperatures are rising into the 30s, if there's still a lot of snow on those trees, kind of maybe try to gently shake some of it off. Try not to, you know, poke them too hard or you know, shake them too hard, but enough to get some of that unloading going on to get the snow to fall. And then from there, as far as pruning this leader out, yes, I think that's a good idea. I would go ahead and get up there in a safe manner, however you need to access it, and then prune it out, you know, right down to about where the branch collar is, if you know what that is. There's some resources on the DNR's Urban Forestry website that shows proper pruning techniques and some guides there with some pictorial images that can really help. But yeah, I think in the winter it would be a good time. And there is a good chance if you select or if there's another vertical leader on that tree, that one will begin to start to grow and straighten up after this other one, and the tree recognizes it's gone. It'll adapt to it, I think.
John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Nick in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hey, we bought a house, actually, it's just a year now. And when we bought a house, the only thing I didn't like was there's no trees in the yard except for one in the front yard. And everybody's like, you need to take that tree down. You need to take that tree down. And I love trees. And she's got to be 100 feet tall. And my only concern is it's about 5 feet from the house. And my concern is how do you know if it's healthy? It's got to be old because it's, like I said, it's got to be at least 100 feet tall.
And it's, do you know what it is? Is it a pine of some sort? Or?
Yeah, it's a pine. It's not a Christmas tree. So it's definitely a pine, though. And like I said, I don't want to cut it down because we don't have many trees. And that's the only tree we have in the yard. And I was just driving home from an errand. And when you drive on our street, you can see it from a block away. It's a beautiful tree.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay, Nick. What do you say, Paul?
Well, this is a question I get all the time. You know, people are growing these trees or they buy property and the trees are right by the home. And I mean, we love our trees close to the home. I love mine, but there are some risks with that. And if trees get older, like Nick says, and it gets a little bit of an odd architecture where there's some tight branch unions or vertical branches that come up, it can create weak points that are susceptible to breakage and windstorms and also snow loading. So it's a good idea to have a certified arborist come out and inspect that tree. I would look at that tree. If it were me, I'd hire an arborist and have them look at any kind of cavities in the tree, any kind of cracks, any kind of other defects that might create a structural loss of strength that might pose a risk if that tree's up against a heavy wind. In the absence of that, in the absence of finding any defects, it's a question of is it worth keeping the tree close to the home if it's relatively sound and strong and it's been there for a long time? Odds are it'll probably be there for a lot longer. But there's risks with that, and it's something to think about. But an arborist to look at it would probably be the first step.
One other problem that can come up, and I'm relating this to the house my dad built in 1958 and planted a willow tree out front, which is still there, and you can't get your arms around it. It's so big, but it was close. And I was down in the basement looking on the side where the tree is, and the basement wall was bowing in.
Yes. Yep. Another risk of having the tree so close to the foundation and the structure.
And so it's something Nick might want to take a look in. Is if he has a basement, take a look in the basement. Not all homes in Door County have basements, but what happened was we were selling the house, so a structural engineer had to come in, and you know, things had to be done expensively to fix that wall so that the structure of the house was okay. And that was just I don't know, 4 months, 5 months ago, something like that. It was a significant bowing. Let's put it that way.
Yes. Yeah, that is a good point. Not only safety, but structure of the home and the foundation. We see that a lot with the most obvious examples, big maples growing by the sidewalk, and they tend to prop up the sidewalk tiles, and that can be an issue. But that also can affect the foundation, too.
Jim in River Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I had a question about buckthorn control, and I've been pretty good to keep. I've got 40 acres, and I got a forest, and I've been pretty good about keeping it out. Unfortunately, my neighbors don't, so I continue to have to work on that. But I've gotten some bigger buckthorn trees I've found now on the lot line, and I'm just wondering about. I know timing is important for that. And in the past, I've killed 40 foot tall locust trees, black locusts, with garland 4. I've girdled them. I think typically that's best as they're starting to go into dormancy in the fall. But I'm wondering if I could do that. I just get so busy in the fall too. On a warm day, if I use garland 4 and diesel on the buckthorn this time of year and partially girdled it and then did a base treatment, would that be effective, or is the timing going to be wrong right now?
Yeah, that's a good point, Jim. I'm glad you asked that question, because we do get really busy in the fall. There's so much fall cleanup to do, finishing up our garden work, whatever other activities are going on. So some of that stuff falls to the bottom of the list. But the great news is that winter, and even in the deep of winter, is a great time to do buckthorn and other shrub control. Things like honeysuckle and Japanese barberry are susceptible to the herbicide when they're applied during a little bit warmer weather. I would choose days maybe in the high 20s or even into the 30s, and then do that mix like you're talking about with the garland 4 mixed with either a bark oil or a diesel that acts as a surfactant, and doing that basal treatment where you're removing some of the bark and scuffing the bark up, or doing a cut stump treatment where you're cutting the tree down and applying it to the cut surface. Those are effective in the winter. A great resource website for that is the Upper Midwest Invasive Plant Control Database. It's an online resource that allows you to type in most of our invasive plants in the Upper Midwest, type in their common name or scientific name, and then get to tables of different management options for them. And most of these shrubs are shown to be highly treatable in the winter. Check that out, the Invasive Plant Control Database.
Jim, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Paul Segan, our guest today, DNR Forest Health Specialist in Northwest Wisconsin. And if you have a question about your trees, I certainly hope you'll join in and give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234 Or if you'd like, you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here on this edition of Garden Talk. We're looking at trees with Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist. Works out of Northwest Wisconsin. And let's callers online. So let's go to Jeff and Barry Mills next. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I had a question about a parcel of land in northern La Crosse County, about 30 acres. That's where I deer hunt. About 30 acres of it was clear cut this summer. And I was wondering what I can expect to see in the future for deer hunting on that north side of the hill, being bare, and the rest of the wildlife and whatever, you know, what I might see in the progression as that forest starts to grow again.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, you know, deer, for very specifically, are an edge-loving species. So oftentimes what we see is these clear cuts do get used by deer in the next, you know, say 5 years after we see the cut. They like to go mill about. There's a lot of what we call bed and browse in these types of openings. Bedding, like if we're getting aspen thicket to grow back, and then also browse. They like to browse on the young seedlings, whether it's aspen or oak, that are coming back. What exactly is going to come back is going to be dependent on whether or not there was some advanced regeneration in the site, meaning, you know, seedlings, saplings that were already growing there, or what seed trees are within close proximity, which are, you know, producing seed and dropping them, or that are blowing in. So I don't know what's going to grow back. A north-facing slope is probably going to have probably more mesic, maybe some pine. You know, if it were further up north, you'd see hemlock more on a north-facing slope. But it's possible you'll have some oak and maybe some aspen. But what I would recommend is, if you haven't talked to a DNR forester, is to have one schedule a visit to come look at that site and see if there's any recommendations they might be able to offer. DNR also has a voluntary program for landowners called the Deer Management Areas Program. And so landowners can enroll in this, and they can get a bunch of extra advice and support from DNR Wildlife biologist on how to improve the habitat for deer or turkey or other game or non-game species on that property. So great to have property, great to see the changes, and really good to kind of stay up to date and educate on what you could do to really appreciate and maybe push along some of those changes.
And you've the visit from the DNR forester is kind of covered by all of our tax dollars. So it's a free service, if I'm not mistaken, Paul.
That's true. Yeah, that's one of the great benefits of the DNR and the help that we provide people, is that this is free of any cost to you. So you can get these visits scheduled and we can come out and help you with giving you that advice. And that's covered in the taxes you pay Uncle Sam here in the state.
Jeff, good luck. Thank you very much. Stan in De Pere, on to you now. Hi, Stan.
Yeah, hi. I was on vacation in England several years ago, and I really liked the English oak. And I'm wondering, will English oak do well around the Green Bay area in Wisconsin? And then I've got a question about Colorado blue spruce. I've got a lot of them in my yard. They do extremely well. Is there anything I have to worry about? I've noticed they're extremely popular with the birds, too.
Yeah, that's a great question, Stan. I'll address, I'm not so sure about the English oak. I'll have to look real quick on that. But I can say Colorado blue spruce, I love them. I love the color. But I have to tell you, I love them more when I see them out in Colorado or the Rocky Mountain West. And the reason is we tend to have issues with Colorado blue spruce in the Lake States. The primary issue is needle cast disease. It's a fungal leaf disease or needle disease that affects these blue spruce. And what it does is it usually starts at the base of the spruce, or the base and or the inside portions of the spruce, where it tends to be a little bit more of a moist microclimate, the types of climate that these fungi really enjoy and thrive in. And they'll start to infect these needles and they'll cast or shed off the tree. And so oftentimes the Colorado blue spruce, it might start out looking really good, but then we tend to get kind of a ragged form where it's missing needles and it just looks a really thin. There are ways to address this. You can use fungicides on the foliage, usually two applications of a copper-containing fungicide during the first part of the growing season, and then second part of the spring, really, after the needles have elongated about 6 inches, a second application can prevent these spruce from getting infected. But it can be onerous, and depending on the size of the spruce, it's going to be maybe not something worthwhile. So if you've already got them, then sure, protect them with the fungicide, avoid any watering around the tree. But if you haven't planted them yet, maybe think about more of a native conifer like a white spruce, possibly a black spruce, or some kind of other screening conifer that might be appropriate. Maybe even hemlock could be good for a screening type of tree. With regard to the English oak, I'd have to look at
they're not a native, as my understanding is they're marginally successful, let's put it that way, in Wisconsin, but they can be purchased in the state.
Yeah, I would look at the hardiness zone a little bit of it and see if it's appropriate for growing in that area, and then read a little bit more about if there's any issues that might be facing it. I think it's a white oak variety, so I don't think oak wilt would be a factor, but whether or not it'll grow here very well, that would be something to look a little bit closer. And I haven't encountered, that I know of, the English oak, so that's a new one.
Yeah, Stan, thanks. There are a couple of nurseries that do sell it in the state. I think Miners, Johnson's as well. So, Bob in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Bob.
I've got a blue spruce, and its variety is Bad Albert. And I'm curious, and as a follow-up to your last phone call,
sure.
What about fertilizer, and what can I plan on, and when can I plan on fertilizing it in early spring?
How old is it, roughly?
It's roughly about 7 years old.
Okay.
7 years old. Okay. You know, you can fertilize the blue spruce. At that age, about 7 years old, it probably doesn't need it. You know, fertilization can really help when trees are young in their first few years while they're establishing. But generally, recommendations are that you can seize or even not have to fertilize after that point that the tree's established. And establishes really once it's a little bit more, the root system starts to grow, the tree's more hardy against drought stress, and its growth rate is more constant and full. But if you did want to fertilize, spring would be a good time. You can use both fertilization sticks. There's like a kind of a stick you can put in the ground of a fertilizer plug. But then also, I think one of the natural ones to use would probably be like a fish emulsion. Larry and I have talked about that before. That's it's a natural product. It has a lot of nitrogen and some of the other micronutrients that are really helpful. And it's just a little bit more bio-rational, as we call it, a little bit more natural product. That would be one to use. I would apply that just around the base of the tree, as far out as the furthest branches go. And I would do it kind of during somewhat dry periods. The thing we don't want to see around spruce is we don't want to see excessive moisture develop. We don't want to see high humidities underneath these trees. We want to try to keep them well air circulated, relatively dry, to prevent that needle cast disease I talked about, which is just so common with these blue spruce.
Yeah, good points. Bob, thank you and good luck. Appreciate it. Wally in Hudson, your turn. Hi, Wally.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I've got a white pine that previous owner planted real close to the driveway. The thing grew, it grew wide and it grew tall. And I've got a 14-foot camphor. I want to know how far I can trim up those branches so the camphor don't hit them.
Well, that, you know, that obviously is going to be some of your decision as to how much clearance you need. Generally, when it comes to tree strength, it can be problematic to prune up too high up the stem of the tree, because what that can do is it can start to cause a little bit more of a, it can cause more of a sail effect on the tree, whereby lower branches they kind of dampen the wind forces. So if we have lower limbs, a little bit lower on the stem, that can help counterbalance a little bit of that heavy wind and the sail effect that happens. So I would say don't prune it more than halfway up the tree. Probably keep at least 2/3 of it, of that stem length, with branches on it, which will help attenuate or dampen that wind load. You won't want that tree to snap off in a heavy wind, especially on that camper you're trying to protect.
Yeah. Good points, Wally. Thank you very much. Jeff emailed to say he has a large silver maple somewhere between 60 and 80 years old. And with the extreme warm temperatures this fall, the tree started budding in late November. And he's assuming this is stressing the tree. What can Jim do to help the tree and limit any adverse impact on the tree?
Yeah, great question. We do see that. We've seen this has been documented more and more over the last probably 5-10 years, is that we're starting to get, you know, in the fall and the late fall, trees are starting to leaf out again. They're starting to bud again. And it does cause stress. It's sending mixed signals to these trees, and they're using up some of their starches, carbohydrate reserves, to produce these tissues. And it does put stress on the trees. Usually the good news is that older trees that are mature and established, like a silver maple, are probably not going to be affected by a couple of episodes, even if consecutive, of this bud formation. So I wouldn't worry too much about it, but generally good cultural practices are going to help this tree. Things like during the growing season, during dry periods, watering the tree, making sure it's got plenty of access to good moisture, mulching around the tree out to the furthest branches or about halfway out if it's a very large tree. You're maybe not going to go out 12 feet of a mulch line, but, you know, maybe 4 feet, mulching with, you know, 3 to 4 inches of mulch, keeping it away from the main stem. But this is going to create a better moisture condition. It'll retain moisture. It will buffer against any root loss during the winter. If we get really cold soils, that would freeze and cause root death. That mulch will help. And then generally good pruning practices, which, again, winter is a great time to maybe take a close look at some of that tree structure, look at some of the guides on the DNR's Urban Forestry website. And if in doubt, have an arborist come and look at the tree and consider some pruning. Because what the pruning can do is if there are weak points in the tree that would lead to big breakage or a big stem breaking out, well, you can get ahead of it by doing preemptive pruning so you don't get big losses of portions of the crown that can really cause some sickness in the tree over time. So good cultural practices generally are going to carry this tree through.
Karen in Holman, we'll go to you next. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if your guest could talk a little bit about his educational and career path to where he got, his path to where he is today.
Where he is today. Yeah, how'd you get there?
So he's thinking about a career, you know, in forestry or whatever, you know, and maybe what other industries might be hiring other than the DNR.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm delighted to get that question, Karen. Thanks for asking. It's the first time I've had that one. But my career path was the following. I went to University of Wisconsin Stevens Point and got a bachelor's degree in forestry. And then I got a master's degree up at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada. So I spent time about 2.5 years up there doing a thesis project on the effects of mountain pine beetle on soil microfungi and also on the effects of soil chemistry. So with that, I then applied for a position at the DNR, and I was offered it, and I took it, and it was the job of my life. It was my dream job. So I love the job I do. But there's a lot of opportunity in forestry for students. Stevens Point's a great institution. There are others. University of Minnesota is a good one. And other programs in forestry are up in the upper Midwest. And so forestry generally can equip you, forestry degree can equip you with the credentials to apply for a DNR forestry position. Sometimes folks might say, I want to specialize in something. Like I decided I wanted to specialize in forest, insect, pests, and diseases. So that's where I decided to go on and get a higher degree, the master's degree. And there are positions out there like that, but they're a little bit more sparse than a forester position. But I think environmental sciences, forestry, it's a great career field. It's just fun to talk and help people with their trees. I'd say it's a lower stress job than some of the jobs out there in finance and business. And it's really rewarding. It's a passion type of job. So I love it. And I'd encourage other students to look into it.
And I know that there are other jobs. There are positions. In fact, many of the tree service companies or some of the tree service companies in the Madison area, they actually advertise the fact that their people who are working all have degrees in forestry in one aspect or another. So And I wondered about something like paper companies or, you know, companies of that nature where you're dealing with trees.
Absolutely. If you look at Wisconsin Stevens Point, for example, in their College of Natural Resources, where I got my bachelor's degree, they have programs in paper science. They have programs in urban forestry, for example, like those tree services are probably hiring graduates from the urban forestry program. And it's the largest one in the whole country. And so, yeah, who'd have thought to be an arborist or to cut down and prune trees, you would want to have advanced degree, but a degree. But it turns out there's a lot of science and there's a lot of know-how in this. And it's a great profession and it's well established now. And I think students should really, really look toward that if they like time outside, if they like nature, and if they like something of a slightly different pace.
Mm-hmm. Karen, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I think UW-Madison has a Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, which is a collection of folks that are interested, some interested in forestry, some interested in wildlife ecology. So another area, but I do know UW-Stevens Point is really kind of a premier institution for that, for sure.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Madison. We won't want to forget it. A number of my colleagues came from Madison, so they'd want to hear a little shout out there too.
Riley in Galesville, we'll go to you now. Hi, Riley.
Hi, thanks for having me on. A number of years ago, we bought a property that had extensive trees planted around the house and in the yard and all over. And you know, I think a lot of the work was done, you know, 25-ish years ago. Some of the trees now, that you know, they have some mechanical damage on them, insect damage, that type of stuff. So we're looking at, you know, taking some of those out and planting new trees. I guess my question is kind of two-part. Do I need to, you know, pay attention to the species that I plant in the old locations, you know, like if it was a pine tree, and I plant a maple in that location? And then how extensive do I have to go in, you know, removing the old tree?
Sure.
Yeah, Riley, good question. Bunch of things come to mind with tree planting on this one. The first is, I always think if you're going to be planting trees in an urban setting, would be to call Digger's Hotline and really establish where you might have below ground utilities, where you're going to be digging, and if there's any hazards there. I do that every season when I plant trees. Some of my properties, I have Digger's Hotline come out and mark it out. And then the other thing you're going to want to start thinking about is tree selection. Which species are you going to plant, and which, you know, all trees are different in terms of the values they provide, the color, whether or not they provide screening in the winter or foliage in the winter, how large they get. Sometimes trees might get too large if there's overhead lines nearby, or if there's a structure, a home nearby, or if there's a drain field nearby. I certainly wouldn't want to put a maple there because of how, you know, fibrous those roots are and they go into little canals. But looking at the site and finding the appropriate species. And so in doing that, the DNR's Urban Forestry website has a fantastic list of different recommended trees for large sites, small sites, conifers, deciduous, and they're in a PDF with pictures of these trees, and it's really well done. It was recently updated last year. I'd highly encourage you to take a look at that on the DNR's Urban Forestry website. And then from there, whether or not you can plant in an old site, generally there's not going to be an issue in doing that. We do have one issue. If we have maples that may have had verticillium wilt disease, it's a type of fungal disease that can affect maple and a few other species. Planting back at a site like that could lead to an issue. So it might be worth, if you see maples or other trees that have some dieback, in other words, some of the branches are dying, but some of the tree is still healthy, or a tree that completely died, you might want to have that tested. You can also have the soil tested to see if there's verticillium remaining in the soil. And if that's the case, you would want to give it some time and maybe avoid that site. But beyond that, planting a deciduous in an old conifer site shouldn't be a problem. As long as the stump is sort of gone and the tree has enough room to, you have enough of a growing area to plant the tree in, it shouldn't be a problem. I think tree selection is going to be your biggest question. And fortunately, there's a lot of resource out there to figure that out.
Yeah. Good luck, Riley. Thank you very much for calling. Bob in Claybanks, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Larry, thanks for having the show. Thanks for your guests making time for it. I've got a maple tree. I'm pretty sure it's a sugar maple. And I've probably dumped four or five latex paintbrush washes by it, and I didn't realize I was under the crown at the time. And it lopped all its leaves probably in July of this year. And someone told me that might be magnesium. There might have been magnesium in these in the paint rinsings, and I wondered if that would cause that, and what I might be able to do to save that tree.
Bob, that is an interesting one. I've never had that question.
I've never heard that one,
Larry. Yeah, I'm wondering here with the magnesium. I suppose what I would think is maybe trying to go into the area where it had that spill or spillage and maybe try a soil test in there. If that showed to be high in magnesium, I'd have to establish that magnesium was a problem. I don't know enough of the nutrient composition and how it would affect the foliage, but that is possible. I think the timing is suggestive. If the tree started showing symptoms after that rinsate was in the root zone, but I might think about a soil test to determine if there's some other, maybe some nutrient there or some kind of other toxic property. I don't know if excavating some of that area would be helpful at this point or not. The other idea is maybe flushing it, trying to get quite a bit of water on it, maybe this spring to percolate some of that down. But that's kind of a new one. I'm kind of at a loss for that.
Yeah, and the soil test, you can get the soil tested. You would need to specifically ask for, make note of the fact you're looking for magnesium as well as other things, but in specific magnesium to see. The soil and plant analysis laboratory can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I guess one last item there, Bob, would be to just, monitor that tree. If you do nothing else, monitor that tree in the spring and look for its condition. What you should expect to see is it leaf out like normal, produce leaves, produce buds and leaves, and then some of that incremental growth on the branches. In the absence of that, then I might think about taking some action and determining. And if it doesn't leaf out at all, it's probably a sign the tree might have succumbed to some effect, perhaps that rinsate toxicity.
Yeah. Good luck, Bob. Thank you. Corey in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Larry. Thanks so much for taking my call. I really appreciate all the variety of programs you have. I have a quick question. I am looking for a source of native tree saplings to plant a pocket forest, and I was wondering if any of the state forestry departments have saplings available for people to purchase or pick up?
Carrie, we don't sell saplings. The DNR has a very well-established nursery program. It's run out of Boscobel, and we also have a nursery in Hayward. We produce a lot of seedlings that go toward both the state properties, some of the county properties, and then also private landowners can purchase seedlings too. And that's actually a good opportunity for a plug here, that there's quite a bit of inventory left on our showing on our website. So those folks who are looking at a reforestation project can both consider contacting DNR Forestry for some guidance and assistance, and then also looking at the nursery website to see what's still available for this 2026 seedling planting season. But as far as saplings go, what I tend to think about is some of the other commercial nurseries, Bailey's over in the Twin Cities area, Johnson down in southeast Wisconsin, and then the DNR also has a list of different private nurseries that sell sapling trees too. And so I would look at those and then consider your site, consider what you want, and then whether or not you want to do bald and burlapped or bare root. It's usually containerized or bald and burlap, and then look at some planting guides and see best practice for planting. But there are a number of nurseries, and what I'm finding in the last 5 years is more and more variety of different sapling species that are suitable to the growing conditions in Wisconsin coming online. In these DNR urban forestry publications, these fact sheets have a whole list of different species that can be planted, and they're really good. And you're going to find quite a few of them at these commercial nurseries too. So definitely check out some of those resources on our website.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Karen in Washburn called, couldn't stay with us. She wants to know, how can places in Wisconsin with old growth forest land be protected from logging?
Yeah, old growth is close to all of our hearts. I know that was one. I got that question earlier today. Was it from Karen, the other Karen, about what got me into this? And I think the pleasure of standing in and hiking through an old growth forest is part of what really caught my heart. And I love these old growth forests. As far as, you know, protecting them, there's a number of, you know, there's a number of organizations that are involved in the protection of old growth in Wisconsin. And also we have the Wisconsin State Natural Areas Program, which protects a bunch of different old growth sites that are, you know, these state natural areas with old growth or even bog type habitat or meadow are really good representations of what were historic plant communities prior to European settlement that caused a lot of change on the landscape. And so these are great places to go and to observe and to hike and do birding and to appreciate. As far as protection goes, I think the DNR is looking at other opportunities to acquire properties that are high exemplar situations of these past plant communities and put them into protection. And we do a lot of control, invasive plant control on them too. So old growth's really important. The DNR thinks it's important. And there's a lot of opportunities out there on the State Natural Areas website to try to access some of these places to appreciate and utilize them.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that question. Paul Segan, our guest, DNR Forest Health Specialist, works out of Northwest Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Taking a look at your trees today on the program with Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist. Great to have him with us. And Matthew in Iron River, Michigan has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. I have several old apple trees here. I've been, over the last few years, feeding them fish emulsion. Seems good. But some of them are in sandy soil and some of them are in clay soil. I wonder if I should be treating them differently.
Oh, depending on the type of soil, whether fish emulsion and so forth.
Yeah, that's a good question, Matthew. I would say I would probably defer to a soil test to determine what some of maybe the residual nitrogen and other micronutrient levels are in that soil. But as a rule of thumb, generally the sandy soils don't quite hold the same level of nutrients that a more of a clay or silty or loamy type of soil would. Sand, you know, the particle size is a little larger. It doesn't have as many of these what we call cation exchange sites or negatively charged sites on these little particles that hold those nutrients like nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, and other micronutrients. And so it tends to percolate down sooner. My guess is that the sandy soil would probably need a little bit more, but I would verify that with a soil test around both of those types of sites to determine what, you know, to really hone in on what your levels and what sort of calibration of nutrients should go on those apple trees.
Yeah, good points. Annie in Dalton, it's your turn. Hi, Annie.
Yeah, we had a small tornado that did a lot of damage to my trees last summer. We lost around 36 trees between the horse pasture and my yard. So I have a lot of replacement to do. I am looking for kind of a mix, apple trees, oak trees, and hickory trees. But when I go on the DNR website, I'm supposed to buy 1,000 of each species at a time. I don't need that many.
So where do you go to get trees in smaller numbers?
Yeah, that's a good question, Annie. Well, I'm sorry to hear about the tornado, and it's great to hear you're taking charge and want to put some new trees down on that site to remediate it. I'm looking right now on the Wisconsin DNR's Bare Root Reforestation site here, and it has a number of nurseries listed here. There's a table with, it looks like about 20 different, 15 different vendors across this, both Wisconsin and Minnesota that you could contact. I would start going through and looking at ones that might be a little closer proximity to your home and then making some phone calls. There's numbers listed here as well as emails and websites if it applies. And I would check in and see what their minimum order size is, what some of the pricing is. And the other thing is it's not too late to order seedlings, but we do see that these nurseries sort of plan ahead on what their demand is going to be. And they do start to, they do start to sell out as we get into the later part of winter. So it's a good idea to start checking on that sooner rather than later. And yeah, right on the, if you go to the DNR's, Wisconsin DNR nursery, you should be able to get to this page where there's the private nurseries listed.
Yeah, and for large numbers, I know in the past, I can think back a long time ago when we were doing that, we got neighbors involved and shared the trees is basically what happened, and that worked pretty well. We had enough neighbors that it worked out well for us.
That's a great idea. Yeah, you might want to check with the neighbors if they've had some damage too. Perhaps they're interested in going in on a bulk order.
Yeah, that's true. Good luck, Annie. Joanne in Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call. I have a older, 50 to 60-year-old home that has white pine grove that the tops are blowing off in the wind, and it's getting real sparse underneath with all of the branches breaking off, and there's a nice litter of pine needles there. What can I plant underneath that will kind of take over once these white pines are too old?
Yeah.
Probably a lot of different things will grow on that site. What I often do and I tell landowners when I'm visiting is nature in the site is often giving us clues and hints at what's going to grow well there. And so if you're seeing oak in the area, maybe you're seeing some maple in the area, those might be well suited to that site. A lot of people think that pine really acidify a site if they're growing there, and the needles really cause a real acidic condition. But generally, it's not enough to really stop other species like oak or maple from growing on that site, as long as they're appropriate for the general site nearby, within 100 feet, a couple hundred feet. They'll probably do fine unless there's some real irregularity with the soil conditions in that particular site. So I would look close by if you need help with identification of what's growing nearby. You could look online for some pictorial resources. And also, there's quite a few apps out there now that help people using their smartphone identify the different tree species, and they can sort of do their own investigative work and get a little bit closer to what's going on their land with those apps too.
So. Joanne, good luck, and thank you. Linda in Oshkosh, what's on your mind?
Hello. I have planted some birch saplings, and I'm wondering how long it takes for them to turn white. They are about 3 to 2.5 inches in diameter now in the trunk near the base, and they're about 20 feet high.
Oh boy, yeah. You know, Linda, that's a great question. I kind of watch these birches, they start to turn white as they get more of that development of the cork cambium. The cork cambium is this cell tissue that starts to divide the bark and creates that kind of, you know, I guess it's a twirling type of bark or whatnot. But, you know, I'm a little surprised at 3 inches, you're not seeing a whole lot more. I'd say make sure it's actually a white birch. Sometimes it could be. Yeah, it could be a river birch, in which case, you know, you're not going to see a lot of white form on that tree, even if it gets older. But I'd say within the time frame of the next few years, when it gets to be about, you know, 5 inches in diameter, I would be very surprised not to see more white form on it. But yeah, take a look. Make sure it is a white birch and not the very common related river birch.
Yeah, I think that's it's possible that is indeed the case, Linda. But you should be able to figure that out at this point in time. Well, Paul, we still didn't get to everybody. We had lots of questions, so you got to come back and do this again with me. Thank you so much.
You bet. Let me know when, Larry. I'll be here.
Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist, works out of Northwest Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us, and I always appreciate his help. He knows a lot, doesn't he? Oh, man. Just a reminder, if you like to hear this or any past show, you can go to WPR.org/Larry, and we'll hook you up. You can go right there and get the information. Great to have a team that we've got. Boy, I'm Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins. We've got Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Brad Kohlberg's been working today with us. Jill Nadeau is our executive producer. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks a lot for visiting with us today and listening in. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.